is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Welcome, friends and comrades, brothers and sisters. I'm Doug Miller, and this is Amandla Radio, a weekly show with news and analysis from about and on the continent of Africa, dispelling negative myths and stereotypes that you get from the mainstream media, and bringing you the background, in-depth insights you won't get from that same mainstream Western media, here at CQUT 90.3 FM. Last Thursday, September 30th, Canada commemorated the first National Day of Truth and Reconciliation. The major Montreal event was organized by the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, Nakaset is the director, in partnership with the Assembly of First Nations Quebec-Labrador, AFNQL. This event is part of the Every Child Matters movement to commemorate the tragedy of residential schools. It was a large gathering and march. There was a sea of orange shirts and flags with the focus of the day on Every Child Matters, those many young people torn from their families who never came home. Nakuset hosted the event and gave speakers from Indigenous communities every possibility to publicly explain, decry, denounce. The colonial mindset has its steely grip over the settler government with its capitalist backers and mindset of greed and exploitation. Old and young explained to the allies who were present that nothing has changed for Native people and decried that the allies had been too long to take action and that much more must be done to end the colonial occupation and the mindset of exploitation that underpins it. The commemoration was wonderful. John A. MacDonald was visibly absent from the pedestal he'd been unceremoniously removed from the year before. His place of prominence was taken by Indigenous speakers, old and young, humble mothers and outspoken leaders, men and women. The communities, the many communities, were well represented and proudly wore their church-forbidden traditional clothes and drummed and sang the songs that the settlers and their religious police tried to banish from memory. But behind the scenes, there was the old story of colonial mindset. On arriving a half hour early, I found a media scrum hiding about 20 meters behind the MacDonald pedestal, diligently recording the political nonsense of Denis Coderre, who's running once again for mayor after being unceremoniously tossed out of office 4 years ago. As a Liberal cabinet minister in the early 2000s, he was instrumental in overthrowing the democratically elected government of John Bertrand Aristide in Haiti to reinstall a neocolonial government less threatening to the interests of American and Canadian capital. I highly recommend you watch the excellent documentary where the CBC journalist Sue Montgomery details Coderre's role in this atrocity. Sue herself is also running for Montreal City Council as borough mayor for NDG and Côte des Neiges. In his platform, Coderre has declared that he would return John A. MacDonald's statue to its place of colonial prominence. So much for truth, so much for reconciliation. The National Day of Reconciliation was also taking place in Place de Canada, in the block just east of the Basilica de Montréal, Mary Queen of the World, and seat of the Archdiocese of the Catholic Church here in Montreal. Once again, colonial hypocrisy was coming to light about all the wonderful promises from the Catholic Church at the time of the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on the cultural genocide carried out in a brutal fashion via the residential school system. Those promises of compensation turned out to be smoke and mirrors, amounting to carrying on the Church's mission of eradicating Native traditional religions and ways. Ellen Gabriel from Kanasataki was especially angry. I've seen and heard her talk many times when she comes across forcefully with logic and argument, but Thursday she was outspoken in her criticism and with good cause. What does Canada's National Day of Truth and Reconciliation have to do with Africa and Amandla Radio? The enslavement of a people? The theft of land and resources through invasion and military force? The eradication and denigration of cultures that had stood the test of time for thousands of years? Colonial mindsets? The Wretched of the Earth, Les Damnés de la Terre, was published 60 years ago. It was written by another colonized subject of imperialism, Frantz Fanon, born in the French territory of Martinique in the Caribbean, educated as a doctor of psychiatry in France, and while working in Algeria, joined the Algerian National Liberation Forces in their struggle through the 50s and 60s to end French colonial occupation. So much has been written about his brilliant examination of colonialism and its impact on the psyche of both the colonized and the colonizer. He's a hero of the struggle for freedom and true emancipation and has inspired generations of revolutionaries and rebels. An old friend of Amandla, Firoz Manji, is a publisher or publishes under the banner of Daraja Press. They have co-published with Zand Graphics Limited an edited analysis by authors from around the world entitled Fanon Today, Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth, edited by Nigel Gibson, a highly regarded specialist of Fanon work. The essays included works by people who have contributed to Amandla over the years as well. What is remarkable about the contribution is they all look at how his ideas are not pure theory, but action. Action that contributes to downtrodden people reasserting themselves, resisting the colonial mindset of capitalism, and struggling to improve their lives. That's where the overlap with the Indigenous anger at the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation comes in. The process of decolonizing the reality of abuse, exploitation, and cultural genocide that North America is growing inexorably stronger and more threatening of settler governments and capitalist high-handed ways with all people, but particularly with BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Fanon and the essays in this book address those issues head-on. Daraja Press is a not-for-profit publisher that seeks to reclaim the past, contest the present, and invent the future. Daraja is the Kiswahili word for bridge. It is, as its name suggests, Daraja Press seeks to build bridges, specifically bridges of solidarity between movements. We aim to build upon, develop, and support interconnections between emancipatory struggles of the oppressed and exploited across the world. In a phrase, our aim is to nurture reflection, shelter hope, and inspire audacity. Where possible, and when authors and co-publishers agree, Garaja makes the full text of the titles available for free download of the PDF version. At the same time, they make printed versions available for sale, and those sales continue to develop, allow them to develop new materials. So we got particularly close to Firoz during the COVID struggle, or the COVID crisis, March 1929. 2019, he immediately set up a series of interviews called Organizing in the Time of COVID-19, in which he interviewed activists around the world and how COVID was having impact on their struggles. As part of the book's launch, Firoz Manji has included so far a total of 4 podcasts available on the Daraja Press website, which feature the authors discussing the contributions. Tonight, I am playing extracts from the 3rd session, recorded last Sunday, October 3rd, 2021. This is the 3rd set of interviews, discussions with contributors to Fanon Today, Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth, edited by Nigel C. Gibson. So the speakers that you'll hear are Toussaint Lozier. Actually, he's in the podcast, but I couldn't get him in tonight's edition of Amandla. He's the author of the chapter in the book called Setting Afoot of a New People, Prison Intellectuals, New African Communism, and the Making of Meditations on Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. Toussaint teaches at the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of African American Studies at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Spu Zikode is the author of the chapter The Power of Bihlali and Our Living Politic Has Been Built with Our Blood. He's the president of the South African Shack Dwellers Movement. He's the first person you will hear. Leo Tissold is the author of the chapter Territorializing Existence as Resistance, a Fanonian reading of the Munduruku and the Riverside People's Collective Self-Determination Processes in Amazonia. She teaches in the Political Sciences Department at the University of Sao Paulo. Because the interviews are so long, I could only include the first remarks by Spu Sikode and Leo Tissold. The podcast will begin after this lovely song by Letitia Lekua. Stay tuned to Amanda Radio here on CQT 90.3 FM.
Good evening, wherever you may be. This is Firoz Manji from Daraja Press. Welcome to today's discussion on Fanon Today, The Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth, a book that was published very recently and edited by Nigel C. Gibson. We have an extraordinary lineup of people to discuss their chapters today. Toussaint Losier is the author and of the chapter Setting Afoot of a New People, Prison Intellectuals, New African Communism, and the Making of Mediations on France Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. He teaches at the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of African American Studies at University of Massachusetts, Amherst, USA. We have from South Africa, Spu Sikode, who I'm sure many of you know, is the author of the chapter The Power of Abakhlali and Our Living Politic Has Been Built with Our Blood. He's the president of the South African Shack Dwellers Movement, Abakhlali Basmajondolo, and he also facilitated a discussion led by Nigel Gibson with comrades from Abakhlali. And from Brazil, we have Leia Dossold, who is the author of the chapter on territorializing existence as resistance, a Fanonian reading of the Munduruku and Riverside People's Collective Self-Determination Process in Amazonia. She teaches in the Political Science Department of the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. I'd like to wish you all a very warm welcome to today. I think this is going to be a really interesting discussion today, I think, because it brings together perspectives that are elaborated in this book, which are, I think, in many ways unusual. That it is not the what we normally see about Fanon, giving a dimension that involves seeing what Fanon really means on the ground in real struggles, and how to actually interpret the extraordinary writings of Fanon, in particular, The Wretched of the Earth, which many of you know is this year the 60th anniversary of its publication. So a warm welcome to you all. And Nigel, let me hand over to you to start the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Feroz. Welcome, everybody. And welcome to what is the third session on this book, Fanon Today, Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth. As Feroz mentioned, this discussion is central to the concept of what the book's about, and that is putting discussions of Fanon back where they should be, amongst movements from below, and in and being discovered and rethought and thought about among movements from below. The first, our first presenter, not really a presentation, but really an opening of the discussion, is Spoo Sakode, who, as Feroz mentioned, is the author of a chapter called The Power of Abathlali and Our Living Politics Has Been Built with Our Blood. And the immediacy of the moment is expressed, and I'm sure Spoo will talk about this, in the release yesterday of three people who had been charged with murder, who were Abathlali militants, and at the same time the continued imprisonment of three others. The charges are trumped up, but I wanted to sort of emphasize another element of it that relates directly to the first page of my introduction, where I talk about the title of Fanon's Les Damnés de la Terre, or The Wretched of the Earth, and its relationship to the song The Internationale, written by the communard Eugène Potier, and then articulated by the Haitian Marxist negritude poet Jacques Roumain. And yesterday I was sent a short video of comrades from Abathlali Basmon Jondolo singing the Internationale and making it their own, and giving meaning to it in a new context. And that is, in a certain sense, the living element of Fanon that we're going to be talking about today. So Spoo, over to you.
Thank you, Comrade Nigel. Greetings to Comrade Feroz, my fellow. Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much to your. Yeah. I'm very grateful to participate in this wonderful discussion, of course, with great minds that are participating here, old comrades that I haven't met for some decades. It's just a wonderful moment. I just want to start off by, you know, locating Fanon in the context of Abathlali struggle. And do want to say, those who may not be familiar with Abathlali struggle, these are the shack dwellers who have decided that we can articulate issues that affect us without fear or favor, without compromising, you know, anything. So the shack dwellers movement that is based in South Africa was started in 2005. It's now one of the biggest social movements to have emerged in post-apartheid South Africa. We have over 100,000 membership that are, you know, active in this movement. Now, the Fanon Today is really interesting for Abathlali, because what was discovered 60 years ago comes to effect and is relevant to our struggle today, which is why we are kind of proud to be engaging in this book and to be engaging Frantz Fanon in the context of our day-to-day struggle. Now, part of the contribution, obviously, on the book that has been edited by Nigel Gibson is, of course, the revelation that Abashkali struggle has been paid in blood. We continue to face these difficulties even today. One would recall how Fanon, you know, deal with the issue of racism, oppression, and his very courageous stance on the exploitation of workers and so on. So today, when we engage him, obviously, we find strength to some of his great thoughts at that time. Nobody knew that 60 years to come, you know, Black African people will continue to be exploited, will continue to live in mud like pigs, as Abashkali continue, you know, to face today. So we have drawn many lessons, obviously, without even having read Frantz Fanon. But when we engage Fanon, we then come to a conclusion that what we come to see today, what we come to realize, what we come to learn today is something that he has articulated very well 60 years ago, which makes the book very relevant today. So I just want to locate Fanon, therefore, in the context of Abashkali struggle for a number of reasons, because as a grassroots organization, we are confronted with exploitation, we are confronted with oppression, we are confronted with racism and all kinds of poverty that we know that the neoliberal agenda continues to advance in order to keep us in deep poverty. So we have had to work hard as the movement to actually talk about this, think about what is going on, but more importantly, think about how do we free ourselves, you know, from the oppression that we face, which is why then it became very important, very relevant for us to really start organizing masses, because we believe that the power of the masses will ultimately bring about the desired change that we want. Now, our struggle would focus on land, decent housing, and dignity. As you would know that if you are poor and Black in South Africa and probably across the globe, you would be taken for granted. Your lives would be vandalized. We have been facing that. Just now, Nigel has reminded us that we have been in court just yesterday for the comrades who have been charged with very serious charges of murder as a way to oppress them, but as a way to silence them, because these are the comrades who have really shown courage in leading the struggle of the oppressed from below. The Ekenana comrades who have successfully built their commune. They have done an amazing work in reflecting, but also educating Abashkali the kind of a society that we envision when we continue to talk about socialism and the kind of a society that we are looking up to. So Ekenana is one of the example, the best example of the commune that we have always dreamt about. And therefore, the state has mastered that, the enemy has mastered that. It has to crush what is emerging in Ekenana. It is for that reason why the entire movement have had to rally its support in defense of the Ekenana occupation in defense of the Frantz Fanon School, by the way, that the community has built, in defense of the cooperatives of poetry, in defense of the community hall, in defense of the spaza shop that is run by the community, in defense of the community gardens, named after our late Nkululeko Gwala. So all these cooperatives in the form of commune are really an attempt to educate us all that this is not the abstract idea of what we want to achieve in the near future. So by doing this, Abahlali is aiming at drawing a line that if we have to be rich, let us all be rich. If we have to be poor, let us all be poor, because everyone has to work very hard for what we have, which is why the question of land becomes so central in Abahlali's struggle. However, in all these efforts of really trying to give an alternative direction to what we can do in relation to fighting the capital system that has failed the mass working class, all these attempts by Abahlali to put an alternative route on the table for all of us to see and maybe to explore, because we have to try one way or the other. We cannot just be stuck in this kind of liberal agenda that have make sure that it only enriches those who are the masters of the systems, who know what is happening, the few that are actually driving the agenda of capitalism. So all these efforts have been attacked in many ways. Abahlali have paid a very price for organizing, for articulating these questions, but for confirming that the work of many intellectuals, and of course, Frantz Fanon today, would have to be defended, would have to help us clear our thinking without now having to read from books, but a day-to-day praxis of what all these thinkings have to say, because it would not help us just to dream at some point. We need to get onto the soil and dirty our hands so that we can at some point agree or disagree that the intellectual thinking is really going to bring about change that we all want. Now, all these Abahlali's efforts are being crushed left and right. Comrades have been arrested on trumped up charges. This is not the set of comrades, the six comrades that are facing criminal justice as we speak. I mean, the three were released on Wednesday, which we are happy, but it became clear from the court proceedings that there was nothing that really linked them to a murder case, which was very dangerous and damaging. It damages the reputation of the organization. The comrades that have been arrested and their families have had to go through difficult times. We know that the message about what is happening is to create fear that those who are courageous in the fight against the system that oppresses us are to face these kind of difficulties. So they are not only arrested, we have faced even torture in the police cells. We've been slandered in the media, we have been beaten, we have also been killed. There are lives that have been lost. So when we say, therefore, that the power of Abahlali has been paid in blood, we really mean that people have suffered. Many of our activists have scars on their back for really standing firm for what is right and what we think should be an alternative in these troubling economic system that we are facing. So fortunately, we've been able to build a very strong movement with people who are very courageous, but also principled in the face of all kinds of threats, including death threats that you may think of. People have stood very firm. It has been a matter of do or die. I think comrades have really realized that it's a do or die. So it would not help us to allow ourselves to be exploited and oppressed, because if we do so, it means we allow ourselves to be killed slowly, slowly. So what is right is really to stand firm for what is right. And this is what Abahlali is engaging right now. So there are really these deep challenges that we face in Shark Settlement, but the movement has really become a hope in many ways because of the courage that the organization has has indicated that it is possible to really stand against all these forces. Now, there has been a lot of achievement in the midst of these difficulties. You know, on the book, obviously, I talk more about the challenges, the price that is so high for anyone to endure. But there are also achievements that I just want to touch on quickly. In the midst of all these challenges that the organization face. So we've been able to keep thousands of families on their homes who otherwise would have been evicted, who otherwise would have been homeless because of the manner in which the state operates. So we were able to keep these thousands of families in their homes. We have successfully occupied vacant and unused land so that the landless and those that are homeless can actually find a home. It has been the duty of the movement and not of anybody else, but it's been a collective work that we were able to contribute in the just struggle for land and housing. But we have been able to build and remain a people's movement, a people's home. People have been able to find hope in the collective work that Abahlali are engaging with, much more engaging in solidarity work between and within struggling communities, not only in South Africa, but across the globe. I think solidarity has been the foundation of the work that Abahlali has done in order to unite the human race. I think Comrade Nigel has just reminded us how the three comrades who were released in prison 2 days ago were welcome in the international way. The song that was really encouraging every human race, that it is important that we become more human, and this is what we commit ourselves, and we think it's very important. Hence, solidarity plays an important role. We know that part of the reason why we were able to win in the court, it has been through the solidarity messages, support in various ways from comrades from around the world, which we deeply appreciate. We've been able to fight the gender inequality and the insensitivity, especially at this time of COVID-19. Cases of gender violence has increased, actually. So it's been the duty of the movement to build these ways in which we can live in harmony, irrespective of the gender difficulties that from time to time people would face. So these are some of the achievements that Abahlali continue to do. But what we have seen in Ekenana, as we continue to see, is that any power, any progress that gets made by Abahlali gets paid in blood. I mean, look at the comrades who have had to spend 6 months in prison for the crime that they have not done. So these are some of the examples that keeps us in this structure, because if we do not, I'm not too sure the extent of the damage that would have happened in our communities. The inequalities continue to be the order of the day. Poverty, the high rate of unemployment. I mean, South Africa has reported more than almost 50% of the country's population are unemployed, with youth, more than 73% of young people are not working. So this has created anxiety, frustration. And what we have experienced in July, the food riots that we've never seen. So Fanon has warned about, you know, that the suffering of the people would not go unchallenged. We have seen this, and we continue to see that the oppressive system may be successful now, but on daily basis, people are trying to find ways in which they can escape exploitation, oppression, poverty, and all other social ills that are working against the working class. So I just want to conclude, comrades, by saying it has not been easy working, you know, in engaging in the struggle of the shared rulers movement. Like many social movements around the world will tell you that indigenous people are often excluded from benefiting from any economic activity. In fact, we get ripped off from what we have created ourselves, what has been given to us by nature, land, and so on. All the territories have been taken away from us, which really strips off our dignity. This calls for us to continue to stand firm for what is right, but we'll only win this battle when we are able to organize so that all these great minds and thinking of that are happening on daily basis, they can only find weight and space when they are supported by popular masses. So Abahlali will continue to organize in order to give effect to the work that Fanon undertaken years ago. So the Fanon today will only succeed and will only make sense when it's not just intellectual thinking about it, but those of us who are really in the forefront of the struggle can actually give effect to this thinking and concur and confirm that actually what has been thought 60 years ago is still relevant. Hence, Fanon today is relevant for the work that we do. There's so much lessons that we can draw, but also those who think about the work of Fanon every day would have done a great job if they do so in consultation and of course observing what the current situation is in grassroots activism. So I just want to leave it there for now. Thank you.
Welcome again to Amandla Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are here bringing you news and analysis about Africa and its people. You've been listening to Nigel Gibson and Miroz Manji animating a discussion with three contributors to the book Fanon Today, Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth. The first contributor was Sbu Zikode, a South African shack dweller activist and follower of the ideas of Fanon. The next that you're going to hear now is Leo Tosold from Sao Paulo University in Brazil, relating Fanon's concepts to the struggle of the indigenous people of the Amazonia.
Thank you, Spoo. What I just want to underscore is the Frantz Fanon School at Ekanana, and the fact that it's not just a school of education. It's as Spoof argues, a school for clarifying the struggle. In other words, directly related to day-to-day struggle. There's an immediacy to the day-to-day struggle, but I also think what's fascinating in what Spoo was arguing about in terms of trying to create a commune, trying to create this commune outside of the state, so to speak, is also the battle of our ideas and the continuing thinking that's going on, that's related to the idea of trying to create the vision of the future in the present. And that very much related to the sort of concrete situation of people who are under threat of eviction and violence and so forth. The continued violence in post-apartheid South Africa, this continued state violence that you cannot escape. And I just want to also say that Fanon's connection to South Africa is one that goes back, of course, to Steve Biko, to Black Consciousness Movement, and the idea of Fanon's thought being alive is something that has continued to be part of social movements in South Africa, both against apartheid and after the end of formal apartheid. The other thing that I thought was important in terms of what Spu was saying and relates to Leah Tosold's chapter is the question of land and the post-colonial situation in Brazil and in South Africa, where the expropriation of land continues, and the fact that, you know, those quote-unquote indigenous people are still being expropriated from their land. And I think that's, and the notion of solidarity, you know, one of the first declarations of solidarity with Abathlali and yesterday when the three comrades were released from jail, but others remained in jail, was from MST in Brazil. So there are ongoing living moment, you know, living relationships between, in this case, South Africa and Brazil. So I want to introduce Leah Tosold, who's talking about, and again, it's a question of existence as resistance. That's the title of her chapter, Territorializing Existence as Resistance. And talking about self-determination processes in Amazonia. Leah.
Hi. Can you hear me, everybody?
Yes.
Okay. So, first of all, I want to thank you all, Nigel, Firoze, Toussaint, Spu. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today. It has been also an honor and an immense pleasure to be part of the collective work that made this book possible in spite of everything. For me, this book is very powerful and inspiring. And as such, it is a huge contribution for the times we are living. I have learned so much from the process that materialized this book, which was permeated by love and confidence. And being at the same side of the trench, I deeply wish to be able to meet you all in person once. So, I was already introduced. I am a Brazilian researcher and activist, and among other collectives, I am a member of the Anti-Racist and Anti-Colonial Studies Intervention Collective, which is known by the name GIRA, and a member of the São Paulo Solidarity Committee to the Resistance Struggles in the Tapajós River region in Amazonia, which is called Contapajós. I have a PhD in political theory at the University of São Paulo, and I just started working now as a postdoctoral researcher at the Free University of Berlin. And as engaged scholar and activist, I work especially on feminist anti-racist epistemologies in order to reflect on collective forms of existence as resistance in contexts in which violence is naturalized and ongoing. And this is the case of Brazil as well. Yes. So in the chapter I wrote, I propose a Fanonian reading of the Munduruku and the Riverside people's remarkable process of resistance to the construction of dams in the middle Tapajós River in Amazonia. And I focus especially in the years between 2013 and 2015, where there was a severe attempt by both the Brazilian state and the private contractors to impose the dams in the region, expropriating the traditional peoples that live there from their territories. So in the middle of already alarming timber and gold exploitation in the region, the construction of mega dams in the middle Tapajós River region, if accomplished, would not only flood their territories, the territories that are inhabited by the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples, irreversibly affecting their lives and the environment as a whole, but would also foster large-scale gold mining, as it happened in the case of the controversial Belo Montes Dam at the Xingu River, and also the expansion of soybeans plantations and cattle fields in the region by making the river navigable for the export of these products. So this is the aim of the construction of the dams there. So in such a context, if the Tapajós River continues to be the last major free-flowing river in Amazonia, this is undoubtedly due to the resistance of the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples in the region. The writing of the chapter draws especially on a collective long-term engagement in an autonomous collective, which is based in São Paulo. It's the Contapajós collective. Along the years, we have been engaged in supporting the Munduruku and the Riverside people's struggles in the Tapajós region through activities, events, and also less visible work that aimed at disseminating reliable information and meaningful forms of engagement with the ongoing struggles in the region. So we organized public discussions, film screenings, urban interventions aimed at calling attention to their struggles. We also disseminated zines, organized a periodical radio program. We helped to translate into other languages the Munduruku letters, spreading their words in activist circles in other parts of the world. We also tried to raise funds for the resistance actions in the region, as, for instance, the Munduruku General Assemblies and the so-called self-demarcation process of their territories. For distances in the region are large, and transport is also very expensive there. So one of our main goals was to enable meaningful connections between different social struggles. For instance, between urban social movements and the struggles of traditional peoples in Amazonia. And also to foster exchange of the Munduruku people with other indigenous peoples in Brazil and abroad. Analysis of resistance processes are framed as exclusively reactive to the colonial or neocolonial schema. And in this sense, analysis of resistance processes are usually captured in attempts of inclusion in an excluding schema. Yes. Such a reactive analytical perspective hinders the political imagination regarding other forms of existing collectively, making the colonization processes, as Kay Wayne and Ivtok points it, coincide with the very expansion of the nation state. Fanon's work, however, allows us to see that much more is at stake in such contextual resistance struggles. Fanon's sharp critique to the nationalist parties, grounded on his sensibility regarding a contextual restructuring of the world, in other terms than the one imposed by the colonial schema, enables us to apprehend the potential of certain modes of contextual collective self-determination processes that are not primarily nor exclusively referenced to the hegemonic norms and laws. In other words, collective self-determination processes, with Fanon, can be regarded as propositive moves that enable, and I use Fanon's words, to tense our muscles and our brains in a new direction, going beyond narrow positional forms of action that end up reproducing the very same neocolonial schema they criticize. In this sense, a Fanonian reading enables more than the identification of resistance practices in a context ruled by total violence. It also enhances our political imagination with already existing other possible forms of living and organizing collectively. It is the proper mode of existence of the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples, with their own standards of reference, that contextually orient resistance process and establishment of other possible forms of common living. Thus, in the chapter, I argue that Fanon allows us to realize that the force of the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples lies, first and foremost, in their existence as resistance, that is, in their potential for collective and propositive self-organization based on their own terms. In other words, their capacity for resistance does not emanate from a merely reactive position, restricted to the denouncement of the alleged failures of the Brazilian state to comply with laws and international treaties, as, for instance, the Brazilian Constitution or the Convention 169 of the International Labor Organization. Instead of proposing corrections or adjustments to them, and so run the risk of being held hostage of the modus operandi of such norms, these peoples patently expose the limits or even the bad faith that are inherent to them. As I argue along with Fanon, this potential to denaturalize the hegemonic norms stems precisely from the primordial and daily commitment of the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples with their own modes of social, political, and economic organization, which confers them a perspective of their own, not only to strategically access and deal with the norms, discourses, and actions of the government and the private sector, but also to establish a fundamentally distinctive way of acting, one that triggers the possibility of unleashing unpredictable and co-moving movements of resistance that are able to reverse the conditions in favor of the traditional peoples of the forest, even under enormous disparity in terms of power balance. I will not be able to enter here in the details of the argument in the chapter, so I just briefly point the three key events of the Munduruku and the Riverside people's resistance process that structure my chapter. First, the occupation of the construction site of the Belo Monte Dam in the Xingu River, which was the construction site was at that moment at its peak, mobilizing more than 20,000 workers 24 hours a day. The occupation not only literally stopped the construction of the dam for almost a month, but also one called attention to the dam's construction project in the Tapajós region, and two, helped to delegitimize attempts of criminalization of the Munduruku and the Riverside peoples by the government through an increase of social movements networks of support produced by the publication of open letters during the occupation. Second, I focus on the process of elaboration of the Munduruku Consultation Protocol, which politicizes the Convention 169 of the International Labour Organization, the one that establishes the prerogative of free, prior, and informed consultation regarding any state intervention in indigenous territories, by tying up form and content. That is, the protocol indicates, the Munduruku consultation protocols indicate that the form of the consultation is undertaken is as important as the content that emanates from it, so that a prior consultation only finds validity if it is conducted in the Munduruku and the Riverside people's terms, that is, according to their own territoriality and temporality. This action helped to expose the lack of veto power of the affected peoples and the governmental strategies to demobilize resistance in the use of the Convention 169. Third and finally, I focus on the process that led to the action of self-demarcation of their own territory, which exposed the underpinning understanding of territory in the law as merely private property, and the bad faith of the federal government in dealing with the struggles of the Middle Tapajós River region, on the one hand, and on the other hand, strengthened local resistance through the fostering of proper modes of collective existence in face of enormous conflicts and pressures that were occurring there in the region. We can, of course, talk more about it later. For now, I just want to finish by saying that the struggle of the Munduruku and the Riverside people is both urgent and inspiring. It is urgent because destruction follows at stride. And it's inspiring for all of us because it is about how life can flourish and in spite of everything. So for both reasons, I am very happy to have contributed to spread these words in this book. And I hope it will keep reverberating in unpredictable ways. So thank you very much for your attention. Sanka lutani fila kono kamenyanina angamo kukasa dungudu kukele munte ban odida bora antansi kanda minisa kanga dukutu kafiru polusa uko kubi normine kubi sudmine klese kunchefe kubani mine
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, that's it for Amandla Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM for this week. A special thanks to Firaz Manji of the Raja Press. His activism and commitment to publishing the struggles of indigenous and colonized people is award-winning. When COVID-19 started in March of 2020, he immediately began a series of Zoom podcasts called Organizing in the Time of COVID that we freely rebroadcast. We helped reprint a seminal work about Dedan Kamati, the Kenyan freedom fighter, which we helped with a radio launch. The new book Daraja has co-published is Fan and Today, Reason and Revolt of the Wretched of the Earth. We'll be bringing you more from Daraja Press on future shows. And thanks to the CQC staff who've kept the station and this show on the air through a very difficult year and a half. Please send any support you can. Check the website at ckt.ca. I'm Doug Miller. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. This is Jazz Euphorium. We have a track rolling right now from Lonnie Smith, who is sadly no longer walking around on this planet with us. This one from 1977. It's called It's Changed. Lonnie Smith, Jazz Euphorium, CKUT 90.3 in the FM.